Thank you for the invitation to this interesting conference. It's very nice to be here, and though I should very much like to be in Norway now, because it is our national day, and that's a big festival. Everybody are out in the streets and celebrating, so I should very much like to be home, but I heard from my children that it's raining so heavy, so maybe it's better to be here in this very beautiful town. We have had different subjects today, and my subject is also a little bit different from the two others. I shall be talking about rituals and mental health related to disasters. And I think it's a fact now that we see in Norway that more people than ever before turn to the churches for ritual participation when something terrible has happened. These new public and private practices are interesting from perspectives of ritual studies, clinical psychology of religion, and practical theology. The Scandinavian countries may be regarded as among the most secular in the world. Also, according to the statistics from Dr. Koenig, we saw that, that they seem to be pretty secular. In contrast to this view, it is interesting to observe the emerging ritual repertoire in the public. The latest and largest example is the ritual response to the terror in Oslo and Utøya on the 22nd of July last summer. The Cathedral of Oslo and the square outside spontaneously became a ritual space. People went there for organized rituals, individual symbolic activities, and they left an ocean of flowers, candles, and memorial notes. Similar places were established all over the country, and the people gathered for memorial services, concerts, and marches through the streets, holding roses in their hands. Maybe you saw it on the television. The cultural framework for these rituals is the traditional Lutheran Protestant tradition of the Scandinavian countries. In Scandinavia, these national churches historically have been functioning in strong integration with public and state structures. The Church of Norway still has approximately 82% of the Norwegian population as its members, taking into account that disaster rituals are part of death ritualizing in our society. It is of particular relevance to observe that the coverage of funeral services by Norwegian Church is at 90% of the entire population. In the traditional ethnic Norwegian population, the figures are even higher. The Protestant churches have traditionally been reluctant to lighting candles and performing rituals which might be interpreted as praying for the dead. However, in our latest versions of funeral liturgies, this reluctance has diminished, giving way for new ritual practices. In this period, since the middle of the 1980s, the Norwegian church has become more ritually open and the public has become more ritually aware. Since the late 1980s, it has become common with memorial services and other forms of ritualizing in the connection with major accidents. By ritualizing, we mean symbolic behavior performed in order to create meaning. Symbol can be understood as an object that is given value or is a carrier of individual or collective meaning. The meaning-making element in symbolic behavior is not at least to establish or maybe re-establish context and structure and then relate to it. In the wake of disasters and accidents, we have seen many examples of ritualizing, from the simple and spontaneous at the accident site to the most planned and comprehensive rituals at schools and workplaces. The public ritualizing after major accidents has not only increased in Norway in the recent 30 years, it can also be found as a cultural trend in large parts of the world, at least in Europe and the United States. Recent research has shown that there has been a growth in this form of expressions in many parts of the Western world, and this growth has also occurred in a tension between ritual traditions and needs-oriented innovations. When an emergency situation occurs following a catastrophic event of significant impact, a common disaster ritual will be held without the first week after the accident and in the acute phase of rescue work and before the funerals. The disaster rituals are normally staged in the local parish church and conducted by the local clergy, who also serve the emergency staff. The disaster ritual in the church is put together by components that are familiar to the participants from funeral services and informal symbolic performances. Rescuers and health workers, together with representatives of local schools and authorities, prepare the ritual together with the clergy. And they are all represented in public roles during the ritual, the rescue workers in their working clothes, police in their uniforms, etc. As part of the press coverage of the accident itself, the disaster ritual is extensively covered by all kinds of media. Rituals after accidents of a national impact sometimes are transmitted on national TV. This was, for example, the case in the memorial service in the Oslo Cathedral after a terror attack last summer. The king, the queen, and the prime minister were present, and most of the government. From the lecture, the prime minister addressed the participants. The media coverage of rituals contributes to form expectations and cultural scripts in the public. The literature on crisis therapy refers to the use of rituals as very important. However, there is little research-based knowledge about the ritual's form and function, although it is currently high degree of scientific interest in rituals. In the following, I will present results from a study of the memorial services after four major accidents with between 4 and 19 dead and many injured. The aim was to deepen the understanding of the function of this particular ritual for the participants. The memorial services were held 1 to 5 days after the accident. We interviewed 10 relatives, one ambulance driver, and 11 clergy, approximately 1 to 1.5 years after the memorial services. Respondents were asked to describe their participation and their experiences in the rituals. In addition to the qualitative interviews, the material consisted of written texts, video recordings, and observations. The bereaved relatives described strong psychological reactions, but in different ways. Some of the participants experienced the situation chaotic or out of control. Others felt strong aggression or restlessness, while others were more apathetic or withdrawn. Some spoke of existential anxiety or ways of pressure on their faith, for example, regarding the question about how God, who is good, could let these terrible things happen. Otherwise, there were little emphasis on religious questions, for example, about death and eternal life, but more about the existential aspects connected with meaning, belonging, and psychological and existential coping. Most relatives searched for community with others and wanted to come to the memorial service, but not all. The parents of a very young deceased boy said that they initially did not want to participate. Most of all, they wanted to be with their family at home and not be exposed to many people through a televised church service. When they still participated, it was partly because they had been advised to do so by their caretakers, but mostly for the sake of their dead child. They wanted him to be represented. Afterwards, they did not regret that they had participated. Some spoke of an early and strong impulse to ritualize. One mother said that one of the first things she did after she was told that one of her children had perished was to go to the local church. As I said, we went to the church then before we went to the accident site. We had not been there yet, but I just felt the need to go to the church the first thing in the evening. This woman was a declared non-believer and not a church member. Other relatives told us similar experiences. Quite spontaneous ways of ritualizing occurred both in churches and at the accident site.
You still alive?
Good. Me too. It seems like the motivation for attending the memorial service increased with emotional pressure, but that this possible pattern. That this possible pattern dissolved when the stress was extremely high and the ability to think and act accordingly reduced. You see, there was they were motivated when the pressure increased, but when the pressure was very high, it collapsed, so to say, because they didn't have the energy. Many commented upon the role of the church building. The church was experienced as emotionally stimulating and safeguarding, both for the better and for the worse. The qualities of the church room were associated with their special architecture and design. The role of the church in human life, in the local community, as well as in the life rites. A relative said, it's not the house that makes the setting. It is what is said and done there, in a way. Said and done, we understand in this context, as another term for ritual use. I think this is a very important point. It's not the house itself that's so important, but all the experience the people have in that house. Several of the interviewees raised issues associated with the majority church and religious diversity. I responded with a human ethical view of life, thought that the liturgical expressions of the ritual might be exclusive to non-church members. However, he said that the church room was ideal and in practice it would be difficult to find alternative spaces with similar qualities. Many of the bereaved had also been to information meetings and more informal meetings and other events at cultural centers, theaters, schools, etc. But they thought that these types of rooms were associated with events that gave different associations and therefore were not suitable for such a strong emotional existential ceremony as a memorial service. One of the relatives said that the church could be used for many different occasions without having been used up. One ritual feature which all the participants had their strongest memories about was the candlelighting ceremonies. In some occasions combined with reading of names of the deceased. In the following, I will present two cases where this ritual element played an important part. First, a woman of 39 who had lost her husband. Initially, I will present some quotes from her narrative to make you know how she experienced the ritual. About meaning, she said, I wanted most of all to stand on the roof of the world and shout out, what is the meaning of this? What is your purpose with this? There can't be any meaning in this. I did not feel any meaning in what had happened, but I felt it meaningful to be there at the service. She said about anger. I was angry with the Lord for what had happened. I wouldn't say I'm a believer, still I sort of have a relationship to the church through my childhood faith. But at that moment, I was terribly mad at God. I couldn't understand how he could do something so extremely stupid. She also said something about comfort. I felt so filled up with human warmth. I felt that all of Norway was there to comfort me. When we were gathered that day, we were good people to each other. Such a memorial service is, of course, very sad. On the other hand, it was not. It was, in a way, a strong mixture of being depressed and exhausted. I had a good feeling when I went out of the church. I felt that there were some people who wanted to go with us and comfort us, wanted to be there for us. This is obviously very important. She had also some reflections about being in the sanctuary. The humans calling themselves believers or not believers, we go to church at the best moments and the most vulnerable moments of life. It is a part of our culture. It is a house where it is high under the ceiling, literally and psychologically. I damned the Lord in all ways, but still I went to his house, you know. She returned several times in the interview to how she experienced the lighting of candles and reading of names, she said. Reading names one by one was very dignified. I didn't look forward to that. It's okay that I say his name, but thinking of others, official persons speaking his name so everybody could hear that it really was he who was dead, that was terrible. I really didn't want that. That would make it so certain and true. The only thing I was thinking of was that his name should be read loudly. That should touch the button in me, and that would make the cup overflow. And so it did. In fact, there was no reading of names in this particular ritual because the names were not yet released from the police, and the clergy actually wanted the lighting of candles to be a more open and multivalent symbol, not only for the deceased. It is good reason to believe that she actually had a subjective experience of hearing her husband's name being read loudly in that ritual. She was in a very unstable emotional condition those first days after the accident, most likely in shock. Another fact was that she had watched another memorial service on TV 1 month before, and in that service there had been reading of names along with lighting of candles. So there's reason to think that a certain cultural script had made its marks on her expectations. In combination with her very unstable emotional situation, this might have colored her ritual expectations, experiences, and memories. She heard it, but it wasn't there. Anyway, this woman subjectively experienced the reading of names, no doubt about that. She turned to this in the interview unasked several times, and she attached great significance to it. She said that it was at the moment when this happened that she really understood that her husband was dead. In other words, this was an important transitional moment with great impact on her mourning and her ability to start looking forward, plan for the funeral, and think of herself as a widow. The second case is about the father of a critically injured boy. In the middle of the night, 7 high school boys crashed their van. 4 died immediately, and 3 were seriously injured. They were all 18 to 19 years old and came from the same community small town where everyone knew everyone. That day of the accident, the day after the accident, a memorial service was held in the town's church. The church was filled with relatives, neighbors, and others from the community. The ritual was led by two ministers from the parish. A highlight of the ceremony was when the names of the dead and seriously injured boys were being read while it was lit a candle for each of them. At the end of the service, there was an opportunity for everyone to light candles. The parents of one of the boys were present. Their son had survived, but was in hospital, seriously injured. The boy's daddy told us that when the candles were lit for one by one of the dead and injured youths, he took notice of the candle which was lit for his own son, and he decided that that particular candle he will take with him afterwards. At the end of the service, he went together with many others to the front of the church for lighting candles. For me, lighting candles is an act of hope, he explained. After that, he went over to the table next to the altar circle where the seven candles lit for the dead and injured boys were placed. He took the candle that was lit for his son. Later, he always had this candle in his sack when he was visiting his son at the hospital. I had an intention by doing this, he said. If something had gone wrong, I would have taken out the candle, his wife said. But we didn't need to do so, the father continued. No, but I had it in my sack all the time when I visited him. I haven't ever lit the candle, but we have taken it out and shown it to our son. A relevant understanding of the candle in the sack is that this is a symbolic way of connecting the son to the collective ritual. The father's actions can be read as a symbol of hope for survival and even as magic in a more recent definition of this term. The anticipation of a palliative function of the candle in case of a fatal outcome for the son also fits into our understanding. Furthermore, this case illustrates the interactions between public ritual and private incidents. Many respondents in our material, like this father in this case, can be said to deliberately cultivate or invent ritual in a conscious and intentional way. They enter into the ritual to some extent from a constructivistic vantage point. One could ask if there is a relationship between ritualizing in this sense and the relevance of the ritual to the individual in an existential meaning and consequently to function. After the terror in Norway last summer, people gathered in their sanctuaries. The Muslims ritualized in their mosques, and the Christians gathered in the churches. There are also many examples of how Christians and Muslims visited each other's sanctuaries. Also, there were funerals for youth with an immigrant background where rituals were ministered by both a priest and an imam. Now, this is quite new in Norway. I don't think I've seen that before. So the situation has some kind of demanding challenges. As mentioned, in our study, all the participants regarded the church as their first choice for a collective memorial ritual. This was not because these persons frequently used to go there, which none of them did, but because these buildings were built for a ritual purpose, expressing basic community values, and charged with highly emotional ritual memories from happy and sad events in generations. The strong affiliation to the church is connected with the rites of passage experiences. The bereaved participants especially pointed out meaning, belonging, community, and transition as important aspects regarding their experienced significance of ritual. So it's time to ask, are disaster rituals therapy? The memorial services take place during the first acute period after an accident. This overlap between the memorial services and the psychosocial health care is unavoidable and necessary. In many communities, local clergy and other religious personnel even serve the psychosocial care staff. This overlap possibly feeds the assumption that these rituals can be understood as a kind of therapy. Such an understanding is limited. And as I tried to show in this paper, it leaves a major part of the rituals poorly understood. The rites are obviously having healing functions, but paradoxically, a medicalization of these ritual practices may have a contrary effect on their functions. The memorial service is a collective ritual response to an extensive experience of crisis. Even if the design of the ritual can be seen as therapeutic, in the meaning that it is designed to meet the emotional needs of the victims and to care for them, the ritual is not to be regarded as therapy. This is because ritual behavior is normal and takes place regularly in non-clinical settings. For instance, funeral services and the performance does not require medical or therapeutic skills in a narrow sense. The disaster ritual is no more therapy than comfort from a friend or help and assistance from a neighbor or a colleague. Ideally, post-disaster ritual is normal, communal, and community behavior in an extraordinary situation. The communal and non-therapeutic character of the rituals is important so that they do not contribute to a medicalization of the post-disaster efforts and a subsequent learning of helplessness on the part of the victims. I think Parliament's understanding of religion as search for its significance in ways related to the sacred sheds light on the ritual behavior after a disaster or tragic accident. What we have seen in Norway last summer and in other occasions is that people are searching for community, comfort, and hope in new ways related to the traditional sacred places. The sociologist Peter Berger, who we remember him from the 60s and 70s and later, he defines religion as the human enterprise by which a sacred cosmos is established. Death is the ultimate threat with which every society must deal. And most societies use religion to make it endurable. The power of religion, Berger writes, depends in the last resort upon the credibility of the banners it puts in the hands of men as they stand before death, or more accurately, as they walk inevitably toward it. I think it is absolutely interesting that people in a society which by many is regarded as among the most secularized in the world search order in chaos, community, comfort, and meaning in stressful times in ways related to the traditional sacred spaces. I'm not sure that people would do so when they stand before death if they did not find the banners from these sacred spaces credible. I think I'd stop it there, because it's a nice picture. This research is done together with Professor Hans Stifos Hansen, so, and you can use the email if you want some more information about it. It's published in the Journal of Ritual Studies and somewhere else. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think it's very interesting to make the following thought, that we try to keep the churches as building and as institution, and now we can see that indeed, even in a secularized country, this is still being used. So I think it's quite encouraging. Now, any question? Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Peter Lacour. I'm from Denmark. Thank you, Lars. It was very good. The point I want to ask about is about the ritual not being a therapy. I agree that it's not a need medical or psychological knowledge to perform a ritual, but it needs some kind of knowledge, a ritual kind of knowledge, a leadership kind of knowledge. And as I understood your paper, it is certainly associated with health. It is a public health action. And a public health action with the aim of reducing anxiety or something like that. It is church in time, I guess, but it is therapeutic, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's very therapeutic. As it is very therapeutic to meet a good friend and cry on his shoulder, but he's not a therapist doing that. So what we are trying to do is to make an understanding of rituals as a normal human behavior and communal behavior. It's something it's a response to a terrible thing happening in the local community or in the nation, and that's a normal thing to do these rituals. And it, but of course they have therapeutic effects, but if we are stressing that point and making these rituals in that to make them function therapeutically, I think we are some sort of destroying rituals as rituals. So I think it's very important to let not the therapists influence too much on how these rituals should be performed, because it's a task for the community, the clergy, and the ritual experts, so to say, to do these things. But of course, what we find very, very clearly in our material is that the clergy, they of course want this effect, that people should be comforted, helped, the transition, that the life should move on, that they should create order in chaos and all these things. So it's there in the planning, but it's not. Rituals are rituals and something different from therapy. That's what we're stressing a little bit.
Okay, thank you. I appreciated this presentation a lot as well. My name is Per Granqvist, and I'm from Sweden, another neighboring country. And I was thinking about the credibility of the banner. In this case, would be the ritual and the ritual site. And I never get my head around in our part of the world whether ritual somehow generalizes to a change in metaphysical belief, so that people would actually start to find the idea of God's existence more credible, for example, following this sort of disaster. I know that your study design doesn't allow it, but do you have any speculations about it?
I have speculations about most things.
Okay, good.
But I think it's like that. I think many people believe in God in Norway. All statistics say that they believe in God or something, a higher being or something like that. The last figures I saw was 68%. It's quite high in a secular country. I think it's something about, it's beyond faith in God. It's about more like the values and the participation in sharing values. And the three words most cited after the 22nd of July last year was faith, hope, and love, which are words very central in the church and in the Christianity, but they're also shared in the society. The politicians, they talk about solidarity, and they talk about democracy, and the values are very close to what are the church values. So I think people are easily believing in the central values of the church, which are central values in the community, but they are particularly expressed in the church. And that's why I think they feel that these rituals are credible and plausible for them to participate in. But they will still work on their faith in God and how God is, and the dogmatic issues, of course.
So we have a question over here. Here it is.
Thank you, that was very interesting. I'm Jacqueline Watts. I'm from the Open University in London. I think what I would like to offer is a sense that we can draw from other disciplines to increase our understanding of the meaning and place of ritual, particularly in relation to different kinds of loss. And social anthropology has much to teach us, because that discipline records in heavy description most often that ritual is about community continuity in different ways. And in that sense, the ritual that you've been describing is about acknowledgement of what's happened, I think, but is also focused on a strong recognition that the community has a role in a public sense in supporting private grief. And I've been exploring different aspects of social anthropology recently, and it's a new discipline to me. And I now understand so much more about the work that I'm doing in palliative care and more broadly in the social context of death and dying. So I just wanted to offer that as a comment and a suggestion, that there are particular works in anthropology that can guide, I think, further understanding in this area. And there's some wonderful, if you like, brief compendia of key thinkers in that area that are very accessible.
Thank you very much. I think your comment is very good, because very much of the discipline of ritual studies is influenced by anthropology and both the way of thinking and the methodology in it. And I think understanding the individual in its context and the community is very important also for understanding not only grief and mourning, but also understanding people when they are ill, because it's a part of the community and the context, which is very visible when we study rituals. So thank you for the comment.
We have a question over here. And please, if people here have questions, so I will ask questions here, get questions here, and then I go on the other side.
Hermann Westering from Austria. A very simple question. You talked about the Scandinavian countries being very secular, maybe the most secular in the world. But doesn't your talk prove that we have to consider the concept of secularity? Because in fact you are talking about ritual as a normal reaction to certain events that would place the whole concept of secularity in a new perspective, namely as a concept that doesn't have very much value in a sense.
Thank you for your comment, Herman. I really agree with you, and it's been on our mind when we have been working with this, that what we see are that the when we are talking about secularity in the ways that people are more or less in the cognitive, dogmatic understanding, do you believe in God or do you not believe in God? I think we are not getting the geography here, because it's very different from that. It's about values, it's about tradition, it's about belonging, and we can learn a lot from sociologists about belonging in a society and the meaning of the church and other institutions and sacred places. So I think we have to expand our understanding about what it means to be a religious or maybe a ritual-using, ritualizing person. What is this about? And I think that our concepts between spirituality, not spirituality, religiousness, not religiousness, they are in a way they're not wide enough to include all these things. So it's a very good question. I don't have an answer, but I'm following your question about this, and I will certainly work more on that question.
Hello, I'm Leah from a hospital near Zurich. I'm still stuck with that therapy aspect of rituals, where you said that it doesn't really have more therapeutic value than, for example, a talk with a friend. And isn't there evidence that the collective aspect of rituals has a more powerful healing aspect than one-on-one relationships?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that it is, of course, very therapeutic. The effect of having close friends who can comfort you and support you when you have bad times in whatever it is very... It has a healing, therapeutical effect, if you should say so. But I think we are sort of destroying or narrowing the focus of rituals, because they're much wider. But we have to be concerned about the importance of rituals when we are concerned about therapy, not because we want to sort of change the rituals to be more therapeutic, but to be aware of the capacity of all these rituals in a context. So I think it's is that what you were thinking? Yeah. Yeah. I think I agree with you. I think that when people are attaching to a collective or social system or people in a congregation or in community or whatever, that has that's part of a healing effect, that the social support is what is the strongest, maybe, to both motivate for therapy and to heal people. So it's a lot of research on just that issue. But my point is not to medicalize the rituals, but let rituals be rituals. Understand rituals from that perspective. But of course, use rituals for in these occasions when it's a good thing to do. So it's not to mix the things. We must have different paradigms of understanding the rituals. Yeah, I don't know. Was it an answer?
So we've got a question over here.
Kevin Ladd from the United States. We've just completed a study on a topic similar to this about prayer and conversation with friends. And one of the components that we're looking at here is the idea that within a ritual in a religious context, there is always an underlying supposition of a metaphysical power that exists in that. If you are equating the conversation with a friend and religious rituals as being fundamentally the same, what does that say to the supposition of a believer who goes in with the idea of a metaphysical possibility that exists there that does not exist in the situation of conversation with a friend?
Well, I would say that the rituals and the conversation with a friend are the same things, but both are examples of important things for an individual which are giving therapeutic effects. But it's not the same thing. A ritual is very different from talking with a good friend, but both these things are important and maybe healing. But the understanding of ritual and religion is very different, of course. Was that what you were thinking about?
So underlying these, then, you would say there are different mechanisms that bring out the therapeutic effects?
It depends on what kind of perspective you have on it. It's if you think that from a psychological perspective, I would say it's more or less the same mechanisms. It's the social support, it's the encouraging, it's the hope, it's the that you are connected to somebody. Then you're not taking a stand if there is a metaphysical entity in these things. You're not interested in that. You're just watching what is happening and describing and trying to understand from a psychological vantage point. But so the effect can be similar, and there are similar things working, we could say, social support, hope.
One last question.
René Hefti from Switzerland. I'm very amazed in the psychiatric ward in our hospital. The pastoral council is doing the Last Supper. Last Supper, with the psychiatric patients, and they like it a lot. They like it a lot, and it's giving them something. I think it's going in that direction. Mm. You know, it's coming together, having this kind of deep community, sharing bread and wine, and I mean there is a transcendent aspect in that. Mm. But I'm really amazed how they love it and how it strengthens them. Mm. So I think there is a secret in it somehow.
It's a secret. Absolutely. Thank you for your comment.